Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Iowa State Senator Amy Sinclair, chair of the State Senate Education Committee and a staunch supporter of education choice. The two discuss the whirlwind of the Hawkeye State's last legislative session, successes in areas such as expanded tax credits for homeschool tuition and textbook expenses for families and teachers, charter school authorization, and expanding district enrollment, as well as the interesting politics behind falling short on attempting to pass an education savings account. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
I'm really excited today to have Senator Amy Sinclair, who is from Allington, Iowa. Senator Sinclair chairs the Senate Education Committee, represents District 14 in Iowa. Senator, welcome to our podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm excited to share our experiences today.
Well, I know that you are a leader in Iowa in education choice, and you had a very interactive session. And so it'd be fun to talk about things that that occurred. So I know that Governor Reynolds had a really comprehensive agenda that she proposed. It got kind of divided up into separate bills for you guys to vote on. But before we get into specifics of the legislative session, I just wanted to, for you to give us a sense of what the status of Ed Choice is in Iowa before the session began. What kind of programs do you have? What are things that you guys have been trying to do in the past? And then we'll talk about what you tried to do in the session this year.
Sure. So a couple of the big things prior to this session, a couple of the big things that Iowa did in the area of parental choice and education and school choice, specifically, we are a district open enrollment state primarily, and then we also had an STO, a tax credit for individuals and businesses who are looking at contributing to the scholarship granting organizations for a given school or a given group of schools. We were early adopters of both of those items early on in school choice. Also, we have some pretty open and generous laws surrounding homeschool. In fact, we have a homeschool that's called independent private instruction that is essentially removed from the public education system, and there's no reporting or connections necessarily unless the parent wishes it. In addition to that, we have robust homeschool assistance programs within a lot of our school districts. I would say primarily in rural areas, just to help those families who might choose homeschooling as their option as well. And so we've long been supporters of parental choice in education, but just probably not at the level of an Indiana or a Florida, you know, but we have pieces that allow parents to make those choices for their children, but we wanted to see it better.
Right. So let's transition to the session. What are the things that you guys tried to accomplish this legislative session?
Sure. And I would just say that Governor Reynolds is a staunch advocate of parental choice and parental involvement in education. And she really came out with an aggressive plan for how our state might advance parental choice and student success right up to the top. And her plan didn't include just an education savings account or just a voucher or just a scholarship or just charters. She put together a package that took all of those, but also rolled in a lot of non-public and public options, a lot of homeschooling options, a lot of tax credits and initiatives that take the whole gamut of what parental choice in education might look like and put it all together in one bill. And so what we tried to do in that bill was to create an education savings account. It was dubbed the Student First Scholarship. She included opportunities for advancing and improving our charter authorization laws. She put in there tuition and textbook tax credits for families, for their children, as well as a tax deduction for teachers that already exists. She suggested doubling that tax deduction for classroom teachers for items that they spend out of pocket. I mentioned that we were a district open enrollment state prior to this year. Unfortunately, we had five districts, three of them being some of the larger districts in our state, who could actually deny open enrollment to students based on their voluntary diversity plans. And so she included an elimination of those voluntary diversity plans as an excuse for denying open enrollment in that bill. And then we also dove into some additional good cause open enrollment options that that allowed for parents and families choosing to open enroll following the deadline, which is a March 1 deadline related to budgeting for schools. On top of that, she put in some innovative programs for public schools so that they could apply for waivers from regulation if they wanted to utilize innovative programming. And that was just that they could have to go through an approval process with the State Board of Education. Honestly, it was if you can think of it related to parental choice in education, whether it's public, non-public, public charter, homeschool, private school, all of the above types of opportunities she included in this parental choice in education package, a student first package.
Wow, that's amazing. So she presented this to the legislature, and then what happened?
Iowa was probably the first state that required our public schools to offer to parents and families the opportunity to come back to school 100% in person. And so we passed a bill right out the gate saying public schools, get your plans in place because parents want their kids back at school and you're going to provide that. And so we actually did that first because I also believe that is a parental choice issue as well. We coupled that with requiring that getting teachers vaccinated up front. So if a teacher wanted to be vaccinated, we were going to keep them safe. We didn't want anybody put at risk if they didn't need to be. And so we coupled some vaccinations with just getting the kids back in the classrooms if their families so chose. And so before we got to the governor's package, we did do that. And that was exciting. And it was signed into law and kids were back in classrooms in Iowa full time, 100% of the time. So that being said, we then transitioned into the governor's proposal, which, as I outlined for you, was a huge proposal. It was pieces of different parental choice bills that I've worked on in the 5 years that I've been chair of the Education Committee in the Senate. We've tried to work around the edges of all of those things. We tried to eliminate the voluntary diversity plans. We've tried to do ESAs. We've definitely looked at improving and modernizing our charter authorization. All of those things that the governor proposed were things that we had considered, probably with the exception of the innovative work that the public schools could do. But all of the tax credits, all of those are things that we've worked on and just couldn't quite get it all together to get it moved forward. The governor produced it for us and presented it to us in a single bill. And so it gave us the opportunity to look at education and parental choice in education from a holistic viewpoint. The Senate passed it and moved it to the House. It was one of the first bills that moved through my committee.
Wow. Yep. So the Senate passed it, sent it over to the House, and then what happened?
that's when the wheels fell off the bus just a little bit. The House took that big omnibus bill for student first success, and they took it apart and put it into smaller packages. Okay. From a procedural and philosophical standpoint, I guess I get that. You want to have single subject bills. But in my way of thinking, we had a single subject bill.
Right.
It was parental choice in education. Right. It was an ed choice bill.
Right. But
the House didn't see it that way. So they dismantled the bill and sent it back to us in several different pieces. The first one they sent to us was the elimination of the voluntary diversity plans. That passed and was sent to the governor with an immediate enactment date. So students who were caught up in some of the worst schools in the state from a student achievement standpoint are now allowed to open enroll to a district of their choice if it makes sense to them. And that was a huge deal for us this year because one of the school districts that were allowed to deny open enrollment was the Des Moines Public School District. And it was the one school district that refused to bring students back to in-person for instruction in any way, shape, or form up through November. And so being able to get that passed through specific to the Des Moines Public School, denying those open enrollments and keeping them out of classrooms, that was a big deal to us. It later came out during the debate process that the Des Moines Public School District had denied open enrollments for just some shocking situations. One young lady had been raped and they had denied her open enrollment request. One young man had been bullied and harassed to the point where he was vomiting before he would go to school every morning, and they denied his open enrollment request. And so we passed that bill. We put an immediate enactment on it so that students who were caught in some of those failing buildings within a system that was denying egregious open enrollment requests so that they could get where they needed to be to get the best education possible for them within the public system. And so that was the first bill that was passed out of the governor's proposed package, and the governor has signed it. Other pieces of that legislation that have since passed was a bill related to charter schools. The authorization process for charter schools in Iowa was atrocious. It could a new charter school could only be authorized by a locally elected school board. There was no state oversight of that. If the local district didn't want to have a charter school within their boundaries, then it was denied. Meaning that at this point, there were only two charter schools in the entire state of Iowa looking at innovative ways to teach and advance student achievement. So what we did was the House passed over their portion of the charter school language. They passed it to us, and we sent that down to the governor. So now we have not only the local district having an option to do a charter school, which is approved through the State Board of Education, but we can also now have a founding organization, a founding group that is made up of Iowans, of people living in the district, parents and community members can form a founding group, and they can be authorized for a charter school through the State Board of Education. So lots of innovative programming going on with charters. So we've passed the voluntary diversity plan, and it's been signed into law. We've passed the charter authorization, and it's been signed into law. We went on to the rest of the bill, excluding the Student First Scholarship, which is an ESA program. The rest of the bill was lumped into a bill that was also sent back to us. And within that, we doubled our tuition and textbook tax credit from $1,000 to 25% of $2,000. So middle-class families who are choosing non-public and want that tuition, their own money back for paying for their kids' public for their kids' education, can get 25% of up to $2,000 back, or $500 now instead of $250. That's also open to families who are enrolled in public schools. If they pay a book fee or fees related to sports and athletics, they can get 25% of those fees back in a tax credit. So they're keeping their own money as they're educating their kids. The big part of that is we also added in families who choose to homeschool. So they can get a percentage of what they've paid for educating their own kids back in the form of a tax credit. These tuition and textbook tax credits are frankly a win-win for Iowa and for families, because the tuition and textbook tax credit actually saves money when those students are going to a non-public school, and they probably would anyway. So those students being in a non-public school saves the foundation formula dollars from a public school. So it's, from a taxing perspective, it's a win on the state. But from a parental choice in education, it's a win for the state too. Whether those families are choosing to educate because of, you know, their religious needs or for smaller class sizes or whatever the reason, it's a win-win, those tuition and textbook tax credits. And that also included the tax deduction for classroom teachers for their supplies. And we also increased the reimbursement credit for our STOs, for the credit that goes into the scholarship granting organizations. We increased that from 65 to 75% and increased the cap immediately from $15 million to $20 million. So that was also in that bill. There were some additional open enrollment good cause issues related to that bill. There was the addition of the innovation that I described, those innovative classroom opportunities that I described are still in that bill. And in addition to that, we added a career navigator to our operational sharing. So districts who are working with other districts and working with community businesses and for-profits and not-for-profits, they can have a central person for like a career academy to direct all of that and connect all of that and have innovation for students in a career academy for those students who may not necessarily be moving into a university setting, but would rather go into the workforce. So all in all, that bill was pretty comprehensive, as you might see. The one piece of the governor's initial proposal that we were unsuccessful on passing was the Student First Scholarships for students who were in that bottom 5% of public districts in the state of Iowa. So ESAs did not advance in the state. That was the one piece that we were unable to get advanced through this legislative session. But all in all, whether your student is going to a public school, a non-public school, whether your family chooses to homeschool or now charter public school, we have robust choice in the state of Iowa that didn't exist prior to this legislative session.
That's pretty amazing. That's a tour de force, Senator. So congratulations. That's pretty.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I know that you were a major driver, and so you clearly have a strong personality, and you're obviously very, very knowledgeable. And so I'm sure that you were a key player in making all this happen.
So I tell you what, I'm the mom of three sons. I have a 25-year-old, a 21-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And if there's a form of education in the state of Iowa that the parents are able to utilize, my family has. My oldest child went to public school, and he was homeschooled, and then he went to non-public university. My middle child was public the whole way. He went to public K-12, and then he went to one of our Regent universities. Both of those older two utilized. We have probably the strongest concurrent enrollment dual credit coursework options available in the nation. And both of those older boys graduated from high school with their associate's degree as well. So they also accessed our community college system in that process. Currently, that 14-year-old is a student at a public K-12 school in the state of Iowa, and likely to stay there. We'll see where he chooses to go for his post-secondary. But the reality of it is, I think the best way to meet the needs of individual students is to have a robust opportunity for them to choose what educational style suits them best. And so I did that for my family, and I'd like to give those opportunities for all the other families across the state as well.
I'm curious about the pushback you got during this session. I know a lot of legislators around the country be interested in sort of the debate, what kind of pushback you got, and how you address that pushback. And what are the primary arguments against what you guys were trying to do?
So always the primary argument, as you've probably heard state to state, always the primary argument is using public funds for private education. Right. That interaction, that play of is this a separation of church and state issue? Now you and I both know that from a constitutional standpoint, every time scholarships and vouchers have been challenged, they've been ruled constitutional, right, with the exception of some funding mechanisms. Was that in Arizona where the funding mechanism was questioned, and that has something to do with their state constitution?
Which, by the way, led to ESAs.
Right. Absolutely.
The Supreme Court said if you do ESAs, it would solve the problem, and that sort of was the founder of the movement of ESAs in the country.
Absolutely. And so so to me, that argument rings very, very hollow. The second argument that we heard was you're underfunding public education as it is. Well, in Iowa, in the 5 years that I've been the chair of the Education Committee, not once have we reduced funding to K-12 public schools. Not once. In fact, we've seen increases every single year, whether that's just through the basic foundation formula increases, or whether that's through increases to the amount we supplement for concurrent and dual enrollment, or whether that is increases we passed some legislation last year to get extra dollars in for therapeutic classrooms for violent classroom behaviors. We have not once reduced the amount of funding that we've dedicated to funding our K-12 public schools. And so again, that argument rings hollow as well. Now, we can debate whether it's sufficient, I suppose. Right. When we're talking roughly half of our state's budget going directly into pre-K-12 education, it's hard for me to think that that's not adequate. Right. And we've also worked on issues within equity, because those are always the concerns, right? Adequate and equitable. So we've worked on issues with equity. Iowa's pretty rural. If you know anything about Iowa, you know that we have a lot of rural areas. And so those districts that are in more sparsely populated areas, we put more money towards those districts to get rid of an equitability issue related to transportation costs. Yeah. And so over the course of the 5 years that I've been the chair of the Education Committee, saying that we've underfunded education is just a lie. It's a red herring to get you off the topic of who truly is in charge of a child's education, and to whom ultimately is that education accountable? And the answer to both of those questions ought to be and should be, and hopefully moving closer to that here in Iowa, we are accountable to the parent who is responsible for educating the child. And anything other than coming back to that ultimate understanding of the educational needs of a child, I think is false and just rings hollow to people who are raising and educating kids.
And you made a good point earlier, which is when you educate a child in a homeschool environment or in a private school, you actually save the taxpayers money, because there's no capital cost, obviously.
Right.
And so in every state, the amount of money that we use to educate a child in a private school or even a home school is a small fraction of the district school cost. So that generates additional savings to the state that can be then used to help fund additional kids in district schools. Talk about the debate around the ESAs. I mean, these debates are happening all over the country, by the way. You probably know that. And yep. Legislation is being passed. And when it's not being passed, it's still there's fascinating debates. Share with us the debate about the ESAs. What were the sort of the pro cons that you heard? And ultimately, that was a big piece that never got through. So I'm just curious why that didn't make it.
And so oddly enough, and I'm sure you've heard this, we had both from the opposers of ESA on from the public school standpoint that don't think private dollars ought to go to non-public schools. Oddly enough, we had opposition from within the non-public sector to some degree, because there are parents and directors of non-public schools who truly have concerns about future strings that might come attached to those dollars. And so they have concerns about what impact that might have on their ability to maintain their autonomy and their independence in their instructional methods within their non-public schools. On top of that, we have some robust public non-public partnerships with it around the state. One very healthy partnership close to my district. I have students who attend the non-public there, where the non-public is fearful that introducing this competition for funds will damage that partnership they have with their public counterpart. So some arguments that you may not have seen coming, some pushback that you may not have seen coming, some additional concerns, and I think this is nationwide as well. With Iowa being such a rural state, there are concerns from rural legislators about what impact a scholarship, an ESA, a voucher would have on their public schools within their districts. I represent a very, very rural district. We're certainly outnumbered by pigs and cows here. And for any of the hunters around the nation, we have some great whitetail down here if you want to come see us. But that being said, I don't have a single non-public secondary school within my district, within my Senate district, and only one grade school. So when we're looking at how that would impact rural districts, rural legislators are fearful, because many of our rural public schools are as lean as they can be, and they're doing all of the things they can to support those rural kids, those farm kids who we don't want to drive those families away to more urban areas. And so we do work very, very diligently to support and protect our rural public schools, just as I talked about with the transportation equity issue. We work really hard to protect them. And so there are rural legislators that push back hard on this because they don't have any non-public schools that would support any of their students. And they're fearful of the long-term impacts of what it would do to their non-public school, or excuse me, their public districts as well. So I guess that's where the conversation kind of evolved around. The argument over whose money is this anyway, and then the argument over how does this impact, whether it's the function of a non-public school through the strings that might come attached, or whether it's the rural public schools and the holistic impact that sending those dollars to follow students might have on those rural schools from a systems perspective.
Yeah, those are common arguments you hear around the country, particularly, you know, you have a state that's really red. Mm-hmm. And so you think, okay, a Republican state is going to be very pro-education freedom. Right. But what you find, as you said, is a lot of Republicans who are representing rural districts where the largest employer is the school district. And like you said, they're trying to keep people in their communities not leaving. They get really worried about it. So even though you might have a Republican, and Texas is a big example, right, where they've been trying to get things passed in Texas forever. But it's a pretty red state. But the rural Republicans keep saying, you know what, I just don't feel comfortable. And so they haven't been able to get anything passed. I'm curious if some of the non-public schools also pushed back because they were afraid about the competition from ESAs. That's been a concern I've heard around the countries. Ironically enough, you know, they're a little worried that if families have additional choices, they may homeschool a little bit more, or they may do some other things as opposed to attending the non-public school. I'm curious if you heard that argument.
Yes, and we did get some pushback from some of our non-publics. Philosophically, they were not opposed, but they did have some legitimate concerns about what changing our charter authorization laws, what impact that would have on our non-public systems.
So let's talk about the future. I have a sense that you're not a woman who rests on her laurels. I just had that sense.
I'm all caffeinated.
So what do you think going forward? What's your next? I know it's already kind of early already, but if you're like me, you're already thinking about next session.
So we gaveled out for the final time for the 2021 session last Wednesday at about 11:48. And by 12:02, I was already talking to my House counterpart, the education chair in the House, about what I wanted to do next year with school choice. And for me, it's always bigger than that. It's not just about targeting options other than our public schools. I am a staunch supporter of our public schools. Frankly, my kid is in a public school, and I am capable of my kid not being in a public school.
Right.
I choose that.
Right.
That's my choice.
Right.
And so when I talk about parental choice in education, it's not to the exclusion of our public system at all. In fact, I want to bolster it just as much as I want to bolster our non-public options, our charter options, and our homeschool options. I think all are vital if we're going to meet the needs of individual students and children, right? But the one thing that I did talk about with my House counterpart that night we adjourned, as we're waiting for the governor to sign the remainder of her school choice bill, was how do we make our tax credits for our STOs, our scholarship granting organizations, those scholarship tax credits, how do we bolster that? How do we make that more viable as an alternative to an ESA, since we're going to have the same legislators next year that we had this year? Clearly, a scholarship program is not going to probably move any more next year than it did this year. So how do we bolster our non-publics in the scope of all that's going on within parental choice in education? And for me, the biggest way to bolster our non-publics is to make our scholarship, our tax credits related to those scholarships within our scholarship granting organizations, a more viable option. You know, if we increase that cap even more, whether it's doubling or eliminating the cap altogether, and also increase the percentage of the credit, I think both of those things go a long way into fostering what can be just essentially universal choice in education without us ever getting into it being public dollars, because it's people choosing.
Right.
To support a non-public system versus paying a tax.
Right. So if
we can get to a place where our STO is attractive enough to garner more contributions, we save the state dollars long term.
Right.
And achieve the goal of giving universal choice to parents as they see fit.